Hi, everyone. I know in recent weeks there's been news of tragic violence inflicted upon Asian American communities all over the country, and probably many more incidents we haven't yet heard about. These incidents include acts perpetrated by individuals, police, and other institutions. While today's episode won't be touching upon those stories, I do encourage everyone to please continue to take care of themselves and each other as best they can. That might include making time and space for yourself to process what's happening, being part of a support network for your loved ones and communities, sharing your time, money, and attention with the people and organizations already doing the work to help our communities, and learning more about the greater context surrounding these continued acts, both recent and historically. Today's episode focuses more on the continued COVID-19 pandemic, and that might feel heavy too. If that's not something you want to listen to right now, it's okay. You can always save it for later. Either way, I hope you're well, or we'll be again soon. Okay, here's the show. Right now, in March 2021, the United States has officially been in a state of pandemic for over a year. Back in May of 2020, Asian Americana covered all sorts of stories about how different Asian American communities were responding to inform, aid, and support each other. But as time has gone on, I think a lot of us have gotten weary of thinking about COVID-19. Obviously, not everyone has that luxury, but I know I've certainly relegated it to the back of my mind. For most of the past year, I've done my best just to keep living my life, or however much I can while stuck at home and not seeing anyone in person. I didn't think about the actual disease itself as much after a certain point, and I wasn't the only one who felt this way.
This was the summer of 2020. We had been in this pandemic here in the U.S. for like 3-4 months, but when my aunt got sick, it was very, very eye-opening, and it was very traumatizing.
That's Denise Chan.
So my name is Denise Chan. I am a journalist and also a producer. I am Asian American, Chinese American to be specific, and I am from the 626, so basically the San Gabriel Valley here in LA.
After her family had to start dealing with COVID itself, she realized how much of a disconnect people had with that experience.
I think that everybody was getting very desensitized with what was happening and what it really meant. I started to realize, you know, even when I would tell people that we were sick, it wasn't landing. Even words like a ventilator or not being able to breathe, I don't think people were registering what that actually meant. That's why I wanted to do this story.
Today, we hear from contributor Denise Chan as she shares her family's experience with COVID-19 from her podcast, Until It Happened to Us, which originally ran in December of 2020. I'm Quincy Surrasmith, and this is Asian Americana. We're still here.
What do you say to a loved one who's about to go on life support? How do you choose the words that might be the very last words they'll ever hear from you? It was the middle of August, and I was in my kitchen trying to record a last voice note to my aunt who was about to be placed on a ventilator. No one expected it would happen this fast. It only took 8 days.
You feel dying. You feel like you were going to die. I just tell them, I need intubation. I just want to relieve the feeling of not able to breathe and not care about the consequences, whether I'll be surviving the COVID or not. I just want to survive the shortness of breath at this moment.
My name is Denise Chan. Earlier this summer, my aunt, my uncle, my mom, and I all got COVID. And to be entirely honest, it was the most intense month of my life. My experience is not different from the millions of families across the world plagued by this virus. As I record this, the U.S. has over 16 million cases. Last week, more people died each day from COVID than on 9/11. For the entire month of August, I felt incredibly helpless. The virus affects each person differently, so it was impossible to predict what each hour would bring. The symptoms my aunt experienced were dramatically different from my uncle, which was significantly different from mine and my mom's. there is no manual for how COVID works. So you hold your breath each day, hoping that things will get better soon. And that's all you can do. Luckily, my family survived, but it was really hard. And I documented it because it was humbling. There are everyday things like taking a walk with my mom or talking to my aunt on the phone that I won't take for granted again. I think it's natural to assume that this won't happen to you. I certainly felt that way, until it happened to us. So here's a two-part story of my family's COVID experience. It was July 24th, Friday night. Auntie Amanda had just finished a very busy week at work, and she was exhausted. She's an emergency room nurse.
I was having a headache. I thought it was just nothing serious. You know, I was just working too hard or something.
She was scheduled to work over the weekend, but decided to take it off. By Sunday night, she started to feel hot. Really hot.
I didn't take a temperature probe to check how high it was. But it was high. I know it was at least over 101. So I keep popping Tylenol.
The Tylenol would help for a couple hours, but the fever and headache kept coming back. By the third day, she knew something wasn't right.
I called my husband. I woke him up at about 6 o'clock in the morning and then asked him to drive me to the hospital.
Uncle Mark and Auntie Amanda got into the car and drove her usual 25-minute route to the hospital she works at. Except this time, she was being dropped off as a patient. As she got out of the car, she told Uncle Mark she'd call when she was ready to be picked up.
I thought I was coming home. I thought they just have to check me out. I told my husband to go home.
She seemed completely normal walking into the ER. Aside from the fever and the headache, it would have looked like she was walking in for work.
I didn't feel any short of breath. I just have the fever and the headache. And if they can give me something that can take care of that, then I can just go home because I don't feel, you know, any serious problems, any serious symptoms at all.
Her coworkers were surprised to see her, but no one was alarmed. They brought her into a private room.
And then the ER doctor told me that he's going to do a complete checkup on COVID. And he even do the ABG, which is arterial blood gas, which is to check the oxygenation inside your body.
Auntie Amanda may have looked all right on the outside, but when her ABG levels came back, it was clear something was attacking her lungs.
When I found out that it was 69, that the normal number is usually 80, at least 80 to 90.
It was the same alarming oxygen level she'd seen from COVID patients coming into the ER for the past few months.
It wasn't feeling good because I know 99.9% that I'm having COVID. And then with the PO2 like that, I don't have enough oxygen in my blood. I know that right then, I wouldn't be going home. I'll be staying in the hospital.
Her hunch was right. Her test results came back positive. She was immediately admitted into the hospital. I didn't know it then, but I wouldn't see her again until October.
Amanda is my sister, so she's a hardworking person. She's kind of stubborn. She likes to work a lot.
That's my mom, Sue. She's also a nurse. She knows how sensitive Auntie Amanda's lungs are.
Last year, she got like a severe attack because one of the patients was wearing a very strong perfume coming to ER, and she was a triage nurse. So after she triaged the patient, immediately, she was like short of breath. So her airway and her lung is kind of compromised in a way because she's very sensitive to extra stimulus.
Given Auntie Amanda's medical history, the whole family had been on edge since the pandemic began. It was only a matter of time.
I mean, as an ER nurse, was this always a possibility for you to have COVID?
Because I work in ER and because I do have asthma, and so I know the chances of me getting COVID is really high. And the chances of me getting COVID serious, you know, with the serious consequences is very high too. I really try to protect myself, but with the work environment, that every patient that comes in is a potential for COVID. And so it's just nothing. You try your best, you know, but there's no vaccine, there's no treatment, there's no nothing. It's part of your job. That's it.
So when her positive results came back and she was admitted into the hospital, we all held our breath.
Her husband, Mark, was still pretty optimistic. Said, oh, she's going to come home. But based on my medical background and everything, I knew that this is like, it's not going into the right direction. But you always hope for the best. And I didn't say much.
So the first day is okay. And then the second day, still okay.
By the evening of her third night in the hospital, a new symptom appeared.
I began to feel very short of breath. I went downhill really fast. I could only walk to the bathroom, which is like about 5 feet away. And I couldn't come out. Just couldn't breathe. And then that night, my heart stopped for 26 seconds. And so they called the doctor and transferred me to ICU.
At this point, she was on high-flow oxygen. She had a fever of 103, 104 around the clock. Her blood pressure was in the low 60s. Her heart rate went down to the 40s. And her shortness of breath was getting worse. She was deteriorating rapidly.
I remember when Amanda was in the ICU, one of the infectious disease doctor, he was very offended when I suggest something to him. So I was asking him whether he was going to find this study drugs that they have been, they're just doing it in the ICU in my hospital. He's just like, no. At that time when I suggest to him, it's just like, I'm kind of like desperate.
At our own hospital, my mom had seen COVID patients crash suddenly. A patient could be stable 1 minute and their oxygen levels could drop to dangerous levels the next. Auntie Amanda was in a very fragile state.
I told him, this is my sister, and if I don't do all these things, later on, I'm going to regret if something happened to her. Because even though she got plasma, convalescent plasma, and she got the remdesivir just on her second day, she wasn't doing better. And then they were saying that, oh, it might take some time for it to work. But time, what is time? Time is like she is already, you can tell her blood gas result was getting worse, even though she was like 100% oxygen on BiPAP. It seems like she was going to get intubated soon, and this is like the last thing that we want her to do, to have it.
My mom started seeking advice from everyone she knew. Doctors at her hospital, ICU nurses, her friends from other hospitals.
I said, Jay, my sister is in a hospital. You know, what do you do with this COVID patient? And, you know, what are the treatments? Let me know. What is the newest that you can do besides poning, remdesivir, plasma, what else?
Her friend Jay was concerned about the hospital Amanda was staying in.
She said, Sue, it's a small community hospital. If the patient needs ECMO, which is that's like the last resort to save the patient's life, and they don't have that because it's community hospital. You need to transfer your sister out. And plus, if her kidney failed and they need to put her in the machine with a continuous dialysis, they don't have that either. Bring her over here. I said, oh my God, this is, she, number one, she cannot just come to the hospital. She's so sick. Even though we sign out against medical advice, she won't make it.
But she knew Jay was right. Auntie Amanda's current hospital didn't have the emergency equipment if she crashed, and her condition was moving in that direction.
I knew how hard it is to transfer a patient out if you're critical and you have to look at what we call higher level of care. One, you have to make sure the higher level of the higher level of care hospital in the tertiary hospital has the capacity to take that patient, one. Two, that the patient is stable enough to be transferred. Because transferring a patient, especially if you are unstable, you need a nurse, you need a respiratory therapist, you need an EMT, and also an ambulance to take the patient, to make sure the patient is okay, just or in case something happened in the middle of the road that they can perform whatever emergency treatment.
We began looking for a tertiary hospital and doctor that would take Auntie Amanda, and we had to move fast while Auntie Amanda was stable. That day, my mom and I sat at the kitchen table calling hospitals, doctors, Amanda's coworkers, insurance companies, social workers, lawyers, anyone who could help. And by that evening, we managed to get everything arranged, except for one thing. Auntie Amanda's attending doctor wouldn't sign off on the transfer.
Attending was trying to stop her from transferring out because she was saying that Amanda doesn't need higher level of care at that time yet.
It was a catch-22.
I was telling her that that is not true because when Amanda crashed, then you guys will say that she's too unstable to be transferred. I said, right now, I have the bed, I have the accepting doctor, and she is stable to be transferred. And you know that your hospital don't have the resource to take care of her when she crashed. So based on those four reasons, I was very adamant telling them that my sister needs to be transferred out.
My mom kept pushing. By the next morning, the hospital approved the transfer.
I got her out, but it was a long battle. It took us like almost 8 hours.
An ambulance would pick Auntie Amanda up that afternoon. She would be moved to a larger tertiary hospital.
Do you remember mom calling you and telling you that you're going to transfer?
Yes, I remember that she kept on saying, don't give up. We are going to transfer you. And you say, yes, you have to go. I remember I got there about 6 o'clock in the evening. The whole floor was COVID for COVID patients.
Auntie Amanda was placed in an ICU room right across from the nurse's station.
I must be pretty darn sick. You only put sick patients there or the non-complying patients there.
By the next morning, Auntie Amanda could no longer text us. Her nurse, Jessie, said she was going to be intubated soon.
Jessie said she is tiring out, so we don't want her to crash.
If we waited until Auntie Amanda crashed to do an emergency intubation, it would be a frantic situation.
It's just like in a chaos. Everybody's running around trying to save the patient, and I don't want that to happen to Amanda. So if she needs to be intubated, it seems like inevitable, then let's do it in a calm, controlled manner.
Auntie Amanda agreed.
So the doctor asked me again, do you want to be intubated? Do you want the tube down if you cannot breathe? And I said, yes, because what is the point of being transferred if you don't want treatment? And the next day by 8 o'clock, I could not breathe. I was saying, like, letter by letter, like word by word, I told them to get the doctor to come and intubate me because I know as a nurse, I know I need to be intubated very soon.
What does it feel like?
You feel dying. You feel like you were going to die. You couldn't. It was a sense of like you need some relief right away. You know, it was like a bad toothache that all your focus is on that pain and nothing else. And you need some relief right away. I just tell them, I need intubation. I just want to relieve the feeling of not able to breathe and not care about the consequences, whether I'll be surviving the COVID or not. I just want to survive the shortness of breath at this moment, at that time.
The doctor said they wanted to intubate Auntie Amanda for a week.
I was like, oh my goodness, awake. I hope they can keep their promise. And I guess at that time she was very tired. She just cannot handle it by herself anymore. She needs help.
That was such a scary moment.
Yeah, because knowing all this data, working in the hospital, whoever gets intubated, they never get out. They can never extubate a patient. We have patients stay in the ICU being intubated in a prone position for 30, 40 days, a COVID patient. So just like, okay, let's keep our finger crossed. That's all you can do. We just have to believe the doctors, believe in the nurses, believe in God, that she'll be able to get out in a week.
As the doctors prepared for intubation, I sent a last voice message to my aunt.
Hey, Money. I love you so much. So, so, so much. Hang in there, okay? I will see you on the other side of this, okay? We are all waiting for you. So, be strong. And, oh, I miss you. And I love you. A lot.
It was a quietly intense week. Two tubes were placed down Auntie Amanda's throat. One went directly to her lungs and was connected to the ventilator to help her breathe. The second was a feeding tube. An IV line was inserted into her neck and her right arm, both for medication. Another IV was inserted into her left arm. This one would draw blood when needed. A last tube was hooked up to drain urine. In total, Auntie Amanda had six tubes hooked up to her body.
You can talk, and your hands are tied down, because once a person's intubated, the hands are tied down, so they cannot accidentally pull the tube out and risk the danger of, you know, being out of breath and dying.
She was heavily sedated.
So for the first 3 or 4 days, I knew nothing about anything at all. Nothing, nothing, nothing. I was totally out.
You were dreaming.
I was having hallucinations. I thought I was awake. But I was having hallucinations the whole time when I was actually, you know, sleeping.
As she slept, there was nothing to do except wait. Auntie Amanda's body had to regain strength. On day 5, they began to lower her sedation.
I was awake on day 5, day 6, day 7.
Her doctors began to wind down the ventilator support. Each day, she would try to breathe on her own a little longer without the machine's help.
And day number 6, when they want to extubate me, I had a fever again. So they postponed it until I don't have a fever, so.
The doctors had to be safe. They monitored her progress closely. They didn't want to risk reintubation. And each day, Auntie Amanda woke up, hoping today would be the day the tube comes out. On August 14th at 2 p.m., the family group text got a one-word text from Auntie Amanda. Extubated. The family text started rolling in. Hi, we are so happy. Woo! Good job, Amanda. Yay! Oh my gosh. Smiley emoji.
And so I was extubated on day number 8. That was a week after I got intubated.
When she was extubated, we were all happy. I think pretty much like 7 days. She was intubated for 7 days. Exactly a week.
She was very weak and she still needed oxygen, but she was finally off the ventilator. For the first time in weeks, I could feel the tension from my shoulders loosen. It was like the family took a collective sigh of relief. And then 2 days later, I had a headache. I had just watched my aunt go from completely healthy to being on a ventilator in just 8 days. And the day she was finally extubated, I was elated. But it was short-lived.
Okay, so today is August, I guess, 17th. Mani is doing a lot better in the ICU, and it's great, but 2 days ago, I started developing this massive headache, and
I don't know what it was. Then the next day I had fever, and I've just had a fever of 100 to 101 every single day since then.
As I sat in my car recording this voice memo, I was terrified.
I just finished getting tested. So far I'm breathing okay. I'm just really worried about stressing mom out. I just want to get better, and I hope this isn't too serious, so it's not that much of a toll on anyone. I'm kind of scared, but I think I will be okay. I will be okay.
The headache came suddenly. It was the kind of splitting headache you get when it's 6 p.m. and you've just come home from brunch. Except I was very much sober.
Do you remember me complaining about a headache that night?
Yeah, I remember, but I thought you were just probably dehydrated. So it didn't alarm me. And besides, we were like finished our quarantine. That was like what? Almost like 18 days or 17 or 18 days. After my knee got sick.
When the headache faded the next day, it was replaced by body aches and fever. I knew something was wrong.
So when you start having fever, I said, oh my God, I remember that Monday. Yeah, I went to work. And then you saying that you got fever. I said, oh my God. I start telling my friends, my coworker, Denise got a fever. My daughter got a fever. I don't know. This is like, she usually doesn't have fever. Young girl with a fever. So I was kind of depressed, even though I was at work. And then all my friends was trying to cheer me up. They said, no, shouldn't have COVID. Why? Maybe she just tired. Maybe just a flu. I said, what flu? It was like August. You don't get flu until winter time. He said, no, flu can come. I said, okay. I hope it's a flu. And then, who told me? He said, oh, yeah, my niece got fever too. And she thought she got COVID, but it was end up nothing. So I said, okay. It's just like all these people were telling me, trying to cheer me up. I said, not sure.
News of my fever spread through the family as well.
They were all worried about me because they said that nothing is going to happen to Denise because she's young and healthy. It was me that they all worry about, including Chris.
Chris is my younger brother.
Chris was so worried. Chris was like, maybe you should stay in a hotel. Hotel? For how many days? And then when we were just trying to think about all these options, he said, Chris was like, you cannot get it. If you get it, it's going to take you a long time to recover. But for Denise, she's going to be fine in a few days. And then in the meantime, I was thinking, how am I going to leave my daughter alone if she's positive? And then I was saying, maybe I should be positive too. Yeah, and then we can take care of each other.
So it's Tuesday, and I just found out I'm positive. And I'm mostly worried about my mom. I don't want her to be positive. I want her to be safe.
Unfortunately, that didn't happen.
I guess God was listening to me. They gave me a positive result.
Compared to Auntie Amanda, my case was mild. But I don't get sick easily, usually once every 2 years. So having a fever was foreign, and having trouble breathing was very distressing.
Okay, we are on day 6. Today was actually really a little bit tougher than the other few days. I have a bit of tightness in my chest when I inhale really deeply. Today is day 8. I'm really tired today. I don't know. Maybe I did too much yesterday. I was having some trouble breathing. This thing is so up and down. I'm so tired today.
For my mom, though, the virus was much more intense.
I was thinking about when when is this going to be over? It's just the feeling of stomach ache, the nauseous and the diarrhea, and couldn't take anything. And you just like, and the fever comes and goes.
Her symptoms started with stomach pains for the first 4 days, and then tapered into a fever marathon. She had a round-the-clock fever for 11 days straight.
When the fever goes up, it's the time that you feel like so fatigued. I hated taking the Tylenol because it makes me like so tired, and then I sweat every night because I usually take Tylenol before I go to bed, and then I will wake up with sweat, and then I have to change the sheet, change everything, change my clothes.
It was a cycle of hell that we could not break out of. It became a routine where each morning would start with 3 texts from the family. How's Amanda? How's Sue? How's Denise? And every morning, I wanted to say things were getting better, but they weren't.
Okay, today's day 9. I'm really stressed. This thing is really, really hard. And I'm tired. And I just want this to be over, and I just want my mom to be healthy.
The days were a blur. Breaking ice packs, counting out Tylenol, keeping a log of her symptoms, sanitizing the kitchen, microwaving frozen food because that's all either of us had the energy for. I even memorized the beeps on the thermometer because I took her temperature so often.
All I know is I was so tired. So fatigued.
On her 7th day of straight fever, I took her to the emergency room. On her 8th day, I took her to the emergency room again. On her 11th day, I took her to the emergency room a 3rd time.
I was just like hoping that, because when I went to the ER, the doctor told me, I said, how many more days? They told me, oh, usually you'll get better in 14 days. I said, what? 14 days? He said, yeah, 14 days. That's what CDC say.
On day 13, she was so feverish she fainted going to the bathroom and almost hit her head. After that, I moved my mattress into her room and camped out. There wasn't much to do except weather the storm. Compared to other COVID patients, she wasn't sick enough to be admitted into the hospital. But she was clearly suffering, and her symptoms weren't improving. Regardless, the medical advice was, wait it out.
It was just like, you don't think much. You just like, at that time, you're just like thinking about, okay, what is next? What is next? It's just like day by day, trying to finish the 14 days as I was told.
On day 14, the fever just went away.
CDC was right. I was like, my fever was gone on the 14 or the 15 days. It just disappeared.
Pulling in. Whoa.
When I finally tested negative for COVID, I drove over to see Auntie Amanda. It had been 2 months since I'd last seen her.
I know. Wait, hold on, Chewie. I gotta put on my mask. And... Okay, come on, let's go. Oh!
Hi, buddy.
Hi, buddy.
It's so good, doggy.
You miss me?
It had also been 2 months since they'd seen Chewie.
Chewie, you're such a good doggy.
Okay, drink some water, Chewie.
For those of you wondering, Uncle Mark had COVID, but he was asymptomatic.
Maybe I should put a mask on.
Hey, buddy, you're walking around without oxygen.
I know.
That's
but
great.
I can shut up right easy.
Yeah, she's right now. She's sure.
My aunt was alive, and I was so grateful to see her walking and talking in the flesh. And deeply appreciative that I could hear about this harrowing experience through her eyes.
Before COVID, I was very good. I was able to do a 12-hour shift, you know, like every day, you know, 7 days a week. Right after COVID, after extubation, I could only walk to the door, which is about 6 feet from my bed. With assistance, with a walker. and then come back to my bed. And then rest a little bit, walk another round, and then I have to rest for 1 hour.
After Auntie Amanda was extubated, she stayed in the hospital for another 3 weeks. When she was finally released home, she was most excited for one thing.
I was looking forward to taking a shower and going to a bathroom. You know, that's like the milestone that you know you're getting better. If you can go to a bathroom, you can walk. The first 2 or 3 weeks, I couldn't take a shower and shampoo together.
She had to separate shampooing her hair because she'd get out of breath being in the shower for too long.
I never knew shampoo and shower couldn't be done together. It's a slow process. Everybody got it. The recovery takes a long time. Some people recover in 2 weeks. Some people recover minimum 6 weeks. You know, there are chances that you might get pulmonary fibrosis from it, you know, stroke, you know, all those things. And then your heart is a little bit, you know, don't know how badly it was damaged.
She'd been recovering at home for 5 weeks at this point. She was still using an oxygen tank every night.
Still has shortness of breath if I overdo it. For sure, if I do the housework for more than 15 minutes, I'll get short of breath because I need to move around.
Do you think you'll be back to normal?
I don't know. Because usually if you get a flu, then when the flu is over, you're back to 100% of yourself. And now, you know, I'm discharged after 5 weeks. I'm not even like 10% back. I hope I'm getting back to 100% normal. If I get back to 80%, I'll be very lucky. I might not. So the only way is try not to catch it.
Do you feel frustrated when you see that people aren't wearing masks and they don't take this thing seriously? Because it ends up, you know, on the healthcare system.
It does. I just think that they take things for granted. They don't take care of their health. Once you lose it, you couldn't get it back. Who wants to lie down there with a tube in your mouth? And even if you don't get into that serious condition, you know, you might pass it on to someone that might get into that serious condition, that might die. Or even if you don't get into that serious condition and you don't pass it on, but you might have the diarrhea, you might have the fever, and you might have the chills, palpitation, chest pain, you know, loss of taste, you know, muscle ache. You know, what for? Just for not wearing a mask? It's not worth it. For us, this is our job. We take care of the COVID patients. And there's no choice. It's your job. But for people who can protect themselves and not doing it, it's not very smart.
It's now December. Auntie Amanda still can't go back to work. She still gets short of breath easily, and her doctors suspect she might have pulmonary fibrosis. My mom is recovered, but still has some lingering chest pains. And I'm pretty much at 100%.
I feel like people are gonna know, everybody's gonna know somebody who's sick. Everybody's gonna know somebody who's sick, and then when you're sick at that time, you're very isolated. There's nothing, you can't really go and help anybody, you can't do anything. So, you know,
as you can still help.
Yeah, so how? What's your advice? How can you help?
So actually, if you're being isolated at home, okay, if you're by yourself, you have a lot of friends, just like what happened to us. We never felt isolated. Theoretically, you're isolated being at home, but with all these friends and, you know, they were bringing food and they left it at the door, by the door, and then we got texts from everybody. You didn't feel, emotionally, you don't feel isolated. So that's one way to help, okay? Even, and also been FaceTime with that person, like giving them some encouraged words. So yeah, that helps a lot, that you can still let her know, or whoever is being isolated, that you care, that you're there.
It was never the big, grand gestures that touched us. It was the small, seemingly insignificant ones. It was the regular check-in text to remind me that even though life was going on, someone remembered that our lives had felt like it had stopped. It was the lack of pressure to respond when things were too intense. It was the food and supplies being dropped off, not simply because we needed it, but the reminder that someone wanted to make sure we're eating.
Like, the family has to be very supportive, you know, and the patient themselves have to not give up. Once you give up, it's so easy to just let go, because it was so easy to just go to the other side, you know, because you were on the brink of between life and death the whole time. So you just have to fight. You really have to fight for your life. I never have such a hard time in my whole life fighting.
What are you most grateful for after this whole thing?
Most grateful that my daughter was with me. Yeah, and we both got COVID, so we took care of each other. Yeah, that's it. And Amanda is okay, got out of the hospital. Yeah, and that's it.
Okay, thanks, Mom.
You're welcome. Never again, please.
You're such a good interview, though, Mom. You are a good interview. I think you are.
Until It Happened to Us is created and produced by me, Denise Chan, for Tread Boldly Productions. Music is by Mayu, Wayne Jones, Unicorn Heads, Div Kid, Ann Annie, JBNA, Late Night Feeler, Patrick Patricios, SYBS, White Sand, Kevin McLeod, The Other Hole, The Tower of Light, and Track Tribe. Special thanks to my mom, Auntie Amanda, my family, and my friends.
That was Until It Happened to Us by Denise Chan. I spoke with Denise to learn more about her story. Denise works as a journalist and producer in both audio and video. She explained why she chose to tell this story in a podcast.
I'm really glad I put this piece out there because there are a lot of people who listen to it that got a better glimpse of what is happening with people who get COVID. And for me to be able to open people's eyes to what that experience is like. And I think part of it is audio. You know, I think audio is so intimate. And I'm glad I chose this medium to tell these stories from my family. I think I knew right away that I had this unique perspective of all of the different ways that this virus hits people. I also wanted to give people a sense of just how differently it affects different people.
That broad range of COVID experiences was reflected across her own family.
You know, my uncle barely didn't have any symptoms. He just lost his sense of smell to me where, you know, I had a fever for like a couple days, had some trouble breathing. To my mom, who by definition, you wouldn't call what happened to her a quote unquote severe case. But I mean, if you think about it, if you have 14 days of straight fever, it's kind of intense. And then all the way to my aunt, who ended up in the ER.
One of the things I thought about throughout her whole story was how difficult it might be for families like Denise's to get culturally appropriate care. Her mom and aunt both worked in healthcare, but not everyone has that background on their side.
My aunt and my mom were both healthcare workers, and so they had a unique look inside the healthcare system that most people don't get. You can hear a sense of strength and conviction in the way that they demand for care, especially my mom, in the way that she demanded that the doctors pay attention to her sister. She knows the medical terms. She understands what it takes to get a patient transferred, for instance. She understands from her own hospital, you know, what the steps to this virus would look like. But I think a lot about, what if my mom wasn't a medical professional? What if my aunt wasn't a medical professional? What if my family didn't have a medical professional to sort of guide us through all of this? It would have been so difficult to understand what is going on. And on top of that, if you didn't speak English, like medical jargon already is tough enough. But on top of that, if you didn't speak the language, you're kind of screwed. You can hear in the piece that English is not my mom's first language. It's not my aunt's first language. I feel like oftentimes when English is not your first language, like you almost have to overcompensate with that level of strength and conviction in order to get your point across to people of authority.
And those barriers affect more than just understanding medical terms.
If we weren't in this pandemic, there are so many little things that normally family members would do for a loved one that's in the hospital, right? You would bring food to them. You can bring a pillow that would make them more comfortable, right? But nobody can visit, right? And so what we relied on heavily was the nurses. And the nurses are taking care of so many other COVID patients all at once. And you're hoping that, you know, they are providing the care that you would provide for your family member. And so if English is not your first language, even the basics of requesting certain things from these healthcare providers to maybe make things a little bit easier, it's just not possible.
Denise's family dealt with these challenges in caring for her aunt in the hospital, too. She shared one more story.
I wasn't able to get into this in the podcast itself, but I remember this moment. So my aunt, she's Buddhist, and right before she was intubated, we were trying to do anything at all to just relieve some of this pain that my aunt was feeling. When you're going through this, like, you just fixate on the one single thing that you can do. For that day, the one single thing that we were trying to do was to get Buddhist music to Auntie Amanda. We're trying to get her these little boxes where it just sings like Buddhist chants over and over and over again, and it's battery operated. We were trying to get just that music box to put it right next to her so that even though she was in and out of consciousness, she could find some solace in that. It could have been difficult to sort of communicate the significance of this if I didn't even speak the language, you know? This Buddhist music box, it's a very specific sort of Chinese, Asian thing that was so important to my aunt's mental survival, in a sense. It was really moving just to get this Buddhist music box to my aunt. We went to temples. We went to like Buddhist stores. We're just like, do you have this? And obviously everything was closed, so we couldn't get any of that. So we're talking to my grandma, and my grandma's like, okay, let me make some calls. And my grandma actually came through because she called her caregiver, and this woman was like, I have one. I'll just drive it over and drop it off. So this woman drove from her house to our house just to drop off this music box. Then we took this music box, got in the car, and we just drove straight to the hospital. And we had to make phone calls to the nurse, and we were like, please, please, please. I know we're not allowed to bring anything up to the patients, but like, would you be so kind as to just like come down and meet us and bring this music box over to her? Like, it would provide her a lot of comfort. And the nurse, Jessie, who is mentioned in the podcast, did that. I like to think it made a difference. But that moment, that day, actually is seared in my memory because it really took a village that day.
Denise really emphasized how important it was for her to have her community show their support when she needed it most.
When my mom and I were sick, and when Auntie Amanda was sick, people would say, oh, Denise, like, let me know what I can do for you. Like, let me know if you need anything. And I was so stressed out trying to keep my mom alive and trying to keep my aunt alive. The things that actually brought a lot of solace and comfort were really small things. It was actually just when people would text me and be like, hey, are you okay? I had people send me flowers. I had people send me like just a book, all the way to just buying me frozen food for my mom and I, so that when we really couldn't move, had no energy to move, we could at least just pop a bun into the microwave and we would have a meal. My friend showed up with a huge pot of chicken soup even when I didn't have the capacity to say, hey, I need food. They would drop off food anyways. All of that makes a difference. I feel like people feel really helpless during this time. Whenever they hear that somebody is sick with COVID, they feel really helpless because it's such an isolating sickness. Like, nobody can see each other. You can't, like, go hug them or comfort them. personally, all I needed was like somebody to remind me that, hey, I am just thinking of you. I just want to check in and make sure you're okay. And you know what? If you don't respond, I'm not going to give you crap for it because I know you're going through a lot. So whether or not you respond, like, I'm still thinking about you and I'm still hoping that you are fine. I don't know. I think this pandemic has been really interesting in changing the way that we show care. I no longer think that showing care necessarily needs to always be like physical. Like there are other ways that you can show tenderness and show that you are there in support.
It's been a few months since Denise's story first ran, so I asked her how she and her family were doing now.
I'm doing good. I mean, it took me about like 3 months before I was fully back to normal, before I could exercise at the same capacity that I had exercised once upon a time. So that was also kind of alarming, but I'm very grateful for my health now. My mom's doing well as well. My aunt, she just learned a couple weeks ago that she does have COVID-based pulmonary fibrosis. Who knows what this will actually mean for her health? And it's because of this virus and all of the scar tissue that's built up in her lungs because of this virus that she's now in this state. You know, the prognosis for folks with pulmonary fibrosis is it could be anywhere from 1 year to 5 years. And I mean, in all honesty, it was really heavy to get that news. I think we're going to see this a lot, and it kind of scares me, to be honest. It's kind of depressing that we don't have no idea about the long-term effects. People are surviving COVID, but like, what does quote-unquote survival mean, right? My aunt actually ended up leaving her job, so she's no longer at the hospital because of her condition. So her last day was 2 weeks ago. We are very much dedicated and working towards figuring out how we can help Auntie Amanda maintain a healthy lifestyle in order to just keep her lung health good. So that's our focus right now. But, you know, Auntie Amanda is good so far.
Despite that news, her family's at least been able to get their vaccines, which would help prevent her aunt from getting reinfected.
Yeah. So luckily, my aunt and my mom, they are both vaccinated, which I'm so happy to hear because, you know, they were going to the hospital every single day. They got it back in like December, I think.
Denise is still waiting for her shot.
But my mom is also vaccinated, so at least I can't get it from her when she comes back from the hospital. And so my mom's like, Denise, you need to be careful. Not that I was doing anything crazy anyways.
Working on such a personal and harrowing story like this can weigh heavily on you. I asked Denise what some of her biggest challenges were in working on this piece.
It was very intimate and it was very personal. And I thought a lot about how much I want to share about my family's experience. You know, whether or not my aunt and my mom would be okay with me sharing this stuff, how much they were willing to share with me. And I will say it took a bit of convincing because she didn't want to relive it. She was like, I don't want to. It's so traumatizing. I don't know why you want to interview me and talk about this again. I kind of had to bribe my mom to give me an interview. So one day she was like, Denise, can you clean the garage? And I was like, I'll clean the garage if you give me an interview. So she ended up giving me an interview. So that's how that shook out. Honestly, Quincy, it was really hard. It was really, really hard to do this story. You know, there's a moment in that podcast where I shared that note I sent to my aunt when I didn't know if I would ever see her again or talk to her again. And I thought a lot about whether or not I should put that up because it's like 30 seconds where you hear just such anguish and desperation and love in my voice. And even afterwards, when I listen back to it, it baffles me because it is crazy to me to hear just how intense I was feeling. So, you know, putting such a personal piece on the air, it was something that was really kind of scary. It was really, really scary, but I'm really glad I did it. And the other thing I'm really glad about is that I had the opportunity to use this podcast to showcase what interesting, smart, quirky, funny characters my mom and my aunt are. I think they're hilarious people in my life, and I'm really glad that people could hear that, but they could also hear, you know, the strength in who they are, because both my mom and my aunt, they're refugees from Vietnam. It's an American story. You know, they immigrated here. My mom came here when she was 16. My aunt was a little bit older. But to see, you know, where they've come from that point to now and the way that they still continue to fight for their own survival, I'm really glad that I had the chance to tell their story in this context. And I'm really, really glad that this piece is able to live as well on Asian Americana so that a new audience can listen to it, because I think your podcast is really great and it tells stories that, you know, a lot of people don't tell. So it's important work. So I appreciate it.
Aw, thanks, Denise. And I appreciate you. We're both just trying to tell more stories. Stories where Asian Americans not only deal with these tough situations, but also get to show their personalities, share their relationships, and just be human. It's the least we can do to better understand each other and ourselves. Thank you to today's contributor and guest, Denise Chan. You can find more of her work on our website, denisekchan.com. That's D-E-N-I-S-E, the letter K, C-H-A-N.com. She's also on Twitter and Instagram at Denise K. Chan. Asian Americana is hosted and produced by me, Quincy Surasmith. Today's guest piece was produced by Denise Chan, with additional editing from me. Our opening song is We Belong by Magnetic North and Tayo Na, featuring Chris Ajima. The song you're hearing with these credits is We Are the Children by Chris Ajima, Nobuko Miyamoto, and Charlie Chin. You can visit our site at AsianAmericana.com, find us on Facebook, and follow us on Twitter at Asian_Americana. If you like the show, please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. And if you really like the show, your donations let us do episodes more frequently and help compensate guest contributors like Denise. You can become a monthly supporter on Patreon. Just click the support button on our website. Asian Americana is a proud founding member of Potluck, a collective of podcasts featuring voices and stories from the Asian American community. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned for more stories of Asian Americana. Want to hear more? Check out this other show from the Potluck Podcast Collective.
Oh. Kathy? Kim?
Steve? Where have you been? We haven't seen you for 7 years.
Has it been that long?
Uh-huh.
Oh. I was on a fishing boat. Training. It's part of the plan.
What training? What plan?
The third season of the Korean Drama Podcast!
Okay, we're doing this again? Okay, but there's no body switching in this one, right?
No! The only thing we're switching is the fact that we're going to watch a good drama this time. From 2020, called Itaewon Class! A story about starting a restaurant and a dish that Koreans love called revenge.
I thought you were going to say kimchi jjigae.
I thought you were going to say juk.
Those two. Koreans love those two.
Listen to the Korean Drama Podcast wherever you listen to your podcasts.
Part of the Potluck Podcast Collective.